For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. We ended last week talking about verse 9 in chapter 2 about how you're a chosen race, royal priesthood, a holy nation, people for God's own possession. That's all from the Old Testament. And then he says, that you may proclaim the excellencies, the virtues, the awesomeness of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. And so there was a darkness that we were in before we knew Christ. He called us out of that. Now our mission is to declare that, to proclaim it, to show the world how cool God really is. Now, jumping down into the next paragraph, he says, and that's kind of the context to keep in mind, all right? And so he bears out one aspect of how we do this, and that has to do with our deeds, the way we live. He says, beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts, which wage war against the soul. So the first thing to notice here is this part about why is he calling them angel and aliens and strangers, foreigners. This is, are all of the people he's writing to living in a different country from where they started? No, they're right. They grew up there. They're native born people in those districts. This is a spiritual concept. It's not that they're literally aliens and strangers, but that on a spiritual level, we're all aliens and strangers. We're foreigners here, living in the midst of something that is fundamentally at odds with our new nature that we're given by God. Let's look at John 15, where Jesus says to his followers, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. So this word, world, in Greek, all of these are the same thing. It's the word cosmos. And it has a meaning that goes way beyond, I think, the English word world. Cosmos means an arrangement, a system, a harmonious order. And it's used in the Bible in a specific way as what I think should be translated a world system. It's a system of thinking and values put together, orchestrated. It's put together by humans, and yet it's being orchestrated behind the scenes by the enemy of God. Orchestrated to captivate people's attention and cause them to become obsessed with certain things, values that never pay off, that are only temporary. And meanwhile, their attention has been pulled away from God onto these other set of values. We read in John 12:31 that the ruler of this world is Satan himself. He calls Satan the ruler of this world, Jesus did. In 1 John 5, it says the whole cosmos lies in the power of the evil one. That's the biblical view, is that, and this is not just talking about organized crime or, you know, drug dealers or child molesters. This is talking about General Motors, okay? The Sears Tower, Harvard. Everything you can think of that constitutes a system of self-promotion, where we work our way up a materialistic ladder, a prestige ladder, and become obsessed with these goals, these temporal goals. I can get this degree. I can get this career. I can move ahead in the company and climb up this way. I can own this kind of house, and so on and so forth. Basically, the so-called American dream is right down this pike, the way a lot, most people conceive of it anyway, of the cosmos. That's the world system. In Colossians 1, We read that God delivered us from the domain of darkness, that would be the cosmos, and transferred us to the kingdom of his beloved Son. So we don't belong. We're not citizens in the world system anymore. In Philippians 3:20, he says, our citizenship is in heaven. That's why we're aliens and strangers. We're kind of passing through here. This isn't our home. You know, we have to be careful for this reason. We don't belong here. It's what Jesus said. You're not of the world. I call you out of the world. So there's a fundamental difference now between you and the rest of the world system. Of course, one of the concerns that God has is the rest of the people in the world. They need to have their citizenship transferred too. In John 17, Jesus praying to the Father says, I do not ask that you take them, my followers, out of the cosmos, but that you keep them from the evil one. So his will is that we live right in the middle of this system, partaking in it, being a part of it. But we're also living as aliens and strangers. There's that mark of difference there because we've had our citizenship transferred. God very concerned about the people in the world system. We read in John 3:16 that God so loved the world, the cosmos, that he gave his only begotten Son so that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. God looks out at the people in the world system. He loves them. He feels bad for them because they've been caught up and are being manipulated by spiritual forces they don't even understand. The values that they buy into, the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, and the boastful pride of life, 1 John 2:15, they think that's just good, you know, healthy living. They think that's all there is. And they've missed the real point, Jesus Christ. They need to know about that. And so God has a real heart for people in the world system. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, Peter's talking about it here. We think we find ourselves then in a position analogous to spiritual insurgents. To insurgents like I said, in France, when you think of the French underground during World War II, they were being organized and supplied by the British. They would drop weapons to them and even parachute in people to train them and organize these underground cells. They had to meet at night in people's barns and things like that. Very dangerous, you know, for them. They could be killed. They would be tortured if one of them was captured. They would be tortured and made to give up the other people there. They often never learned each other's names. They would call each other. Everyone was named Mr. Smith. So that if they were tortured, they couldn't give up people's names and stuff. Of course, that wasn't always possible because they were neighbors. But, you know, think about this notion. We're not coming into the world system. You know, there is spiritual warfare going on, but it's not a frontal war like what you would think, like when the Allies landed, you know, in Normandy. Then it was line, you know, battle line warfare where they drove the Nazis back. That's not the nature of what we're involved in. We are infiltrators. We're like the underground, living in the middle of occupied territory, dangerous territory. Of course, our French people, they're on our side. They may not know that. We can't just go talking to people openly necessarily. There is hostility here. What Jesus mentioned, you know, if you were of the world would love its own, but you're not. And so they hated me, they're going to hate you. So, when you're living as an underground fighter, you got to be more careful than you would as a normal soldier. Underground fighters have to be very cautious. Who can I talk to? If I talk to the wrong person, they're going to rat me out to the Gestapo, and I'm going to be strung up with piano wire somewhere. It's going to be really bad. So I need to talk, but I got to be pretty careful about who and when I decide to talk to people. I need to avoid things like breaking discipline. One of the big problems the British had with the underground in France before Normandy was some of them would just get so pissed that they would just go off and just say, let's get them, and just start, you know, wasting Nazi officials. And the British called them adventurers. You know, they weren't under control. Of course, it never did any good. So let's say you were, you know, meeting with your little underground cell of, you know, 9 guys, and you're part of this village and so forth, and you're just like, I've had it. You know, the Gestapo's been oppressing our people and so forth. We had to go down to Gestapo headquarters, drag that leader out, and let's hang him in the street. That'll teach him. Well, that ain't going to teach them nothing. Okay? All that's going to do is blow your cover. It's going to bring incredible heat down on the whole city. You're going to get wasted if you do that. You don't want to break discipline. You don't want to blow your cover and, you know, pull out the brass band and bleed it down the middle of the city. You're underground. You've got to keep your cool. You definitely have to avoid misdirected aggression. Aggression that wouldn't do any good. So this, the underground fighter is a very disciplined person. You know, what if you were like, man, the Germans are making us pay taxes, and then they use that to expand the Wehrmacht and just oppress us even more. We should have a tax revolt. Let's get everyone in the city to refuse to pay taxes. That'll teach you. Again, that's misdirected aggression. That's not going to do them any harm. Are you kidding? A power as great as Nazi Germany is not going to be hurt by that. And what they're, you're going to be hurt by what they do. They're basically, you accept the reality of occupation. You play along with that. And you bide your time, you train, you arm, you get ready, and you do what your operators, your controllers say. Now, once the Allied invasion of Europe happened, right before that, the British activated hundreds of these cells, and they went out and blew up bridges, you know, train tracks and so forth, and created a terrific disruption that made it very difficult for the Germans to reinforce the front. And, you know, eventually they got their chance to hang the Gestapo guy too. There's some of that went on too, but at the proper time. Well, I just think it's a picture, you know, I think frankly that in the modern West, a lot of Christians don't comprehend this and think that what we're here to do is to bowl over culture, you know, with the power of Christianity. They want to elect Christian politicians and get them in government, and then we'll pass laws, you know, that will like force people to not be sinful or something like that. I'm not even sure how the logic works, to tell you the truth, but it's a power thing. It's all about gaining power, taking America back. I got a disc sitting on my desk. I was going to take some clips out from it, but I didn't get time. And it's a fundamentalist ideal that, you know, we need to get America back in the hands of the godly. And then we need to legislate against the ungodly, and that's how things are going to be done. Peter says we're aliens and strangers. That's what we really are. Of course, we have to guard against inactivity too. We can't just hunker down and just, you know, not do anything. We have a mission. The whole point of being part of an underground movement is that you're trying to accomplish something. And so one of the things, and really where this comes out, this is a group, okay, that is under persecution. It's crucial to see in the writing of 1 Peter that he's writing to people who are under pretty bitter persecution. And we don't know all of the details of that, but we know typical types of persecution in the first century. You know, included rejection from the community, loss of your work and job that you had, loss of your property, imprisonment, beatings, and death. So this could be pretty rough stuff. People probably had lost friends and or relatives in this persecution. There's definitely the danger of that if it hasn't happened yet. In every one of these cities, when one of these ancient cities turns against you, it's murderous. I mean, it's not a civil thing like we have today. You know, how many of us have really ever seen somebody lynched or beaten to death? It's pretty unrare, unusual in our culture. They saw it on a pretty regular basis. That was not unusual in their day. And so this is the kind of thing you're facing. You got to be careful. He says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, on account of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. So to keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. The Gentiles are, you know, all the other people that you're living around, who don't get it, who haven't become this nation of God, the people of God, everyone else. What are we supposed to do to them? Well, keep your behavior excellent. Behavior counts in this type of scenario we're talking about, where there's a danger of persecution, there's a danger of hostility. How do we stem that? How do we work with that? By good behavior. It's your deeds. Not as, even more than your yapping. That matters too. You know, we do speak. We do persuade. We have to pick our times for that. We got to pick our situations. We're looking for people that are open, people that are responsive, that are interested, you know, in discussing key issues like spirituality and stuff like that. But there's also the issue of our behavior. And often, if we understand correctly, our behavior will open doors for these discussions. That's biblical teaching, not just in this passage, but in many others as well. He says, when they slander you and tell people, these people are dangerous, these Christians, cult members, they're sick, they're crazy, you know, they're spreading their poison in the ears of our children or whatever. It says, when they see your good deeds, then they'll observe them. They'll glorify God in the day of visitation. A lot of times the way we overcome slandering, he says they slander you. The way to overcome slander is with good behavior, where you're just such a good person. So good that when people hear the slander, they're just like, no, I know one of those people. There's no way. It's not what they're like. One of the nicest people I know. So what Peter's putting forward is the world is watching us. I like the title of one of Francis Schaeffer's books that came out around when I was a student. It was called The Church Before the Watching World. I thought, well, yeah. Good title. We are in front of the watching world. They're watching us. They may not agree with us. Sometimes they won't listen to what we have to say, but they're watching. They're definitely watching. Your families are watching. Your friends at work, people at work are watching. And if once they know that you're a believer, they're going to watch you. So, I know we take this pretty seriously. We've certainly set up. We have a lot of good examples. I just heard a story today about a ministry house that had a woman in their neighborhood who was super hostile. She was calling the cops on their ministry house all the time. Every time they'd sit out and have a party or just anything, the cops were always showing up. And they finally figured out who it was. They cooked her a cake. They started going over and talking with her. They basically made friends with her, cleaned up her yard. And it's gotten to the point where she's decided she really likes them. And so they talk all the time now and stuff. She never calls the cops anymore. Yeah. That's what Peter's talking about right there. How do your neighbors view? I got a letter from another lady about a ministry house in her neighborhood. She says it has the F word, you know, spray painted all over the side of the house. Filth, dozens to hundreds of beer cans laying in the yard. People out making, you know, screaming, laughing and carrying on at, you know, 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. You can't get any sleep. We went over and tried to say something. They told us to F off and go to hell, you know, and just cussed us out. God, I hate hearing stories like that. What a disgrace. And just think of the wrath and contempt that that has brought down on all of us. Not just that misbehaving group of idiots in that house. I gave them a piece of my mind on it. You guys familiar with Renegade? A fantastic ministry that's going on right in this building with kids around this neighborhood here, underprivileged kids. A lot of them really in a lot of trouble in their lives, you know, broken, shattered life situations. These are often illiterate kids that the educational system has failed bitterly and so forth. We've got scores of workers in with a couple hundred kids, tutoring them, caring for them, befriending them, showing them a way. These are kids that have never known love. Never. And everyone around here was so suspicious when they heard this group was buying this block and coming in here with some kind of religious group and stuff. And you wouldn't believe how the attitude is changing. You can go right up and talk to neighbors here and ask, like, we love Xenos. They are so good for this community and our kids needed this. And they're so generous and sharing and everything else. That's what Peter's talking about right there. Keep your behavior excellent. Now, if somebody came into that neighborhood and was like, oh, these guys are bad news. These guys are dangerous. They'd be like, you don't even know them, do you? Because we know all about them. We see what they do week in and week out, year in and year out. We think of the free clinics that we offer. And just so people can come in, people that can't afford to go to a doctor. And they can come in. They can see doctors. They can see nurses. They can get prescriptions and be healed free. Because they're poor. And people learn about that. So hundreds, thousands of people have been impacted by the free clinics we do here and out on the west side. We think of Urban Concern, a ministry embracing hundreds and hundreds of underprivileged down in the lower Linden area. We think of City Light on the west side. I don't know how many of you are aware of the extensive ministry they've got with hundreds of kids, again, from very blighted, very disadvantaged neighborhoods. And that these types of things, and there are many others, these types of things are our best bet for, you know, getting the, not only getting the community off our back in terms of being critical and negative, but really opening doors and people saying, you know, I think I had a wrong impression of you guys. I think I'm starting to see this. There must be something good about this group or they wouldn't be doing so much good. When you carry out good deeds, that's pretty hard to argue with. Especially when it's not just a window dressing, but you're going down hardcore, long term, with high expense, and really wading in and building relationships with the disadvantaged. It's pretty hard to argue against that, actually. In the early church, this was very influential. We have a writing, this is from Julian the Apostate, an emperor of the Roman Empire, who had started out in a so-called Christian home, defected from Christianity, went back to polytheism, which he calls the Greek religion of the Greeks. It's polytheism. He says the religion of the Greeks does not prosper. Why do we not observe? Why can't we see how the charity of Christians to strangers has done the most to advance their cause? And Julian hated Christians. He wanted to persecute Christians. He says it's disgraceful that these Christians support our poor in addition to their own, while those who belong to us look in vain for the help that we should render them. This was the observation that we read about multiple times in the ancient early church period, is that people were just blown away. you know, a plague would hit one of these ancient cities, a disease. And people were just scared to death of these diseases. They didn't know what caused them. They had no idea what to do about them. And they would just run for the hills. Just get out of here. And anyone who was sick was just left behind to die. And they and what started happening is everybody would run except for the Christians. They would stay and nurse the sick. Many of them got sick and died that way themselves. And they were willing to pay that price. And so this made an incredible impact. This is part of why you see such large numbers getting their mind blown, changing from the view that Christians are people that deserve to die over to they seem to know something that we don't know. Their deeds. It's a big emphasis in the Bible. In Titus 3, Paul says to Titus, our people must also learn to engage in good deeds so that they can meet pressing needs, and that way they won't be unfruitful. And in 1:16, he says, some people profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny him. Boy, I kind of feel that way about that one ministry house I mentioned. You know, you hear that, you heard this, you just read this story from this lady, some middle-aged lady that lived in the neighborhood. And then just imagine those guys coming over and saying, we'd like to tell you about Jesus. Oh. Of course, they would never do that. I'm sure anyone that selfish probably didn't even care about their neighbors that much. But the sad thing is that, you know, somehow they had put together that this house full of fools was linked to Xenos somehow. And so it came back on all of us. The negative deeds come back on us, just like the positive deeds do. The good deeds come back on all of us, and we can all benefit from our reputation. Titus 2:14, Jesus gave himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify us for himself, a people for his own possession, zealous for good works. That's eager, looking for chances to do good deeds. That's the way Christians should be. Titus 3:8, these are all in one little book, okay? So there's so many others in other books, but just think about Paul writing, here's one short three-page book. How many times does doing good works come up? And this is in his instructions to a top leader in that area. I want you to speak confidently so that those who have believed in God will be careful to engage in good deeds. Alan Kreider, a historian, says of the early church, the main factors that led people to become Christians were healings and exorcisms. They were impressed with the power over the demons the Christians had. The dignity given to women and the poor in the Christian community, including slaves, and the astonishing practice of spontaneous goodness, especially to the poor and needy. There are source materials all over the place on this. I want to read also a few thoughts by one of my favorite authors, Andrew Murray, in his excellent book, Working for God, which is in the public domain. This can be gotten for free as an ebook. He quotes Ephesians 2, 9 and 10, which says, by grace you have been saved through the faith, not of works, lest any man should boast glory. He's got the old school stuff here. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God afore prepared, that is, prepared beforehand, that we should walk in them. Okay? About this passage, Murray says, we have been saved not by works, but for good works. That's what it says, doesn't it? He's right there. That's God. It says we were created, we are his workmanship, created in Christ for good works. And it says that God has created them, has prepared them beforehand. So it's not even like we have to come up with this, pull a bunny out of the hat, you know, and invent good works to do. But actually that if we're attentive to God, he's going to lead us into situations where we're going to have these opportunities And he's going to also supply the power to do it. Murray goes on, he says, think of how God foreordained his servants of old, Moses and Joshua, Samuel and David, Peter and Paul, for the work he had for them. And he foreordained equally the works for them. Okay, we just studied this. We were just studying Exodus, right? We saw that way before Moses had any idea of what was going on, he was in the basket. He was picked up by Pharaoh's daughter. That was all God orchestrating things. God was preparing them beforehand. God knew what Moses was going to do later, much later. He started way ahead of time, started working. We saw how the burning bush, and God came and called him. God was able to articulate everything he's going to do. You're going to go up to Egypt. There's going to be plagues. And Pharaoh's going to let the people go. Now let's go. And so God, who knows all things, who has absolute foreknowledge, and in light of his foreknowledge, he arranges situations. He's arranging things. Clearly, he arranged the whole thing with Moses. It's this way with all of them. With David, Samuel was going through the brothers. There were brothers, 11 brothers, waiting for the Lord to tell him which one to pick as the next king. He's like, none of them. So you must be kidding. Are there any other sons? Well, just this little shaver out in the field. Let's bring him in. It's him. This is the one. The greatest king in the history of Israel. God marked him. God knew exactly who he was. He showed him to Samuel. See, you think of Paul struck down on the road to Damascus, and Jesus articulated what you're going to do. You're going to be a witness before kings. You're going to suffer. You're going to go through this and that for me. And you see him out on his missionary journeys. The Holy Spirit won't let him go there. He won't let him go down here. It makes him go, and there's a dream. He's supposed to go over here. And so God, the whole way through, see what this is what Murray is pointing to here. God is way out ahead of us, pre-arranging for good deeds, good works. And then we get to kind of fall into those works. We get to kind of come walking along and we fall into those works. And it tends to be a lot easier than you would think because it's been prepared by God. I think it's a pretty profound thing to think about. What does it imply, the fact that God is preparing good works for me? For one thing, it means that I'm not going to fail when I do those works. They've been prepared by God. And not in the spiritual sense. I mean, I may get persecution. I may get, someone might reject me verbally or whatever, but I'm accomplishing the works that I was given to do. He says, the Father's prepared for the humblest of his children, their works, just as much as for those who are counted to be chief, the great ones. Sure. Moses, David, Paul, those are great ones. But right down to the humblest person. Because you read that passage in the second chapter of Ephesians. It's everyone. We're all saved by grace. And we're all created for good works, which he has prepared ahead of time. Well, I think this is pretty comforting, frankly. That does a lot for me to know that I'm not out here trying to make this happen on my own. I'm following after God who's leading the way and setting things up for me every step of the way. Oh, man, do I ever believe that. I see it now. I can look back and I see all these points at which God stepped me into completely without my knowledge, stepped me right into the perfect situation, the perfect, had me say the thing that needed to be said. And it worked out so awesomely. I don't know what would have happened if he hadn't gotten me right where I needed to be at that point. Many points I can articulate like that. Matthew 5, Jesus said, you are the light of the world, the cosmos. Let your light shine then before men, that they may see your good works, it's your deeds, and glorify your Father who is in heaven. A lot of times people quote this as, let your light shine means you're supposed to witness, you're supposed to preach, you're supposed to proclaim. Actually, it's your works That's what he says is the light. It's the way you live. Oh, man. I went into one computer shop to get something for work, and I used my Xenos credit card. The guy looked at it, he says, "Xenos," he says, "this is some kind of Christian group, isn't it?" And I was like, "Yeah. What have you heard and stuff?" And he says, "Well, I've been actually wanting to check it out." He says, "You know, I had this guy here named Dave," and he named the guy, I knew him. He's a worker here in Xenos. He says, "You know, he was a part of this group," and he says, "I have to tell you," he says, "he doesn't work here anymore, and I feel very sad. He's moved on to a better career," but he says, "You know, he was the most awesome employee that anyone has ever had. The kindest, the most truthful, you know, conscientious, exceeding every, you know, if there was ever a need, he would try to meet it the best he could. He just said he seemed to emanate love." He says, "I had me to his place. I met his wife." He's like, "He's probably the most awesome guy I can think of. And he's part of this group right here." And I just thought, "Gee, that is what should be." And there is somebody seeing someone's good works and glorifying God. Murray goes on, he says, "It's when our works thus too are something more than the ordinary virtues of refined men, when they bear the impress of God upon them, that men will glorify God." It's got to be good enough that people sense this is not normal. Most people will do good things occasionally. This has to be more than that. He says the great majority of those who are counted as believers today are doing nothing toward making Christ known to their fellow men. Boy, that was true all the way back then. And it's still true. Of the remainder, the majority are doing so little, and that little is so ineffectually that by reason of the lack of wholehearted devotion to God, that they can hardly be said to be giving themselves to their Lord's service. Wow. That's depressing to think the church was that lame back in Andrew Murray's day. This was written about 1901. He says, "What can be done to waken believers to a sense of their holy calling and to make them see that to work for God, that to offer themselves as instruments through whom God can do his work, ought to be the one aim of their lives." He says, all believers should be like that. That's hardcore. All of our good works, he points out, are not produced by us, but by the Lord. He cites John 14:10, Jesus speaking. He says, "The Father in me, abiding in me, does the work that you see." Even Jesus lived a life of dependency on God and trusted that God would cause the miracles and the works he did to flow from him. Christ counted it no humiliation to be able to do nothing of himself and to be always and absolutely dependent on the Father. When shall we understand that to wait on God, to bow before him in perfect helplessness, to let him work all in us, is our true nobility and the secret of the highest activity? This really is. I think Murray's got his thumb right on the pulse here. This is what we need to do. We don't need to be self-motivated activists. We need to be people who are bowing in helplessness before God and waiting for those works that he has prepared beforehand. As this life is known and maintained, the life of complete surrender to God, the power for work will grow because the soul is in the attitude in which God can work in us as the God who works for him that waits upon him. Well, so here's a little thinking, and you see where this is generally headed, but now he spells out some specifics. First of all, I think he says we need to submit ourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. This was written at a time when the Roman government was one of the cruelest in history. The emperor, when this was written, was probably Nero, who even the Romans considered really vile, really sick, Nero slew thousands of Christians. And he did it brutally. We have an account in Tacitus where Nero had a garden party. And when his guests came in, the nobility of Rome, to this garden party, there were posts all around the party with impaled Christians on the posts, soaked down with naphtha and lit on fire. That was their tiki torches. For entertainment, Nero brought out a bed and had public sex with a young boy. Now that is an a-hole there. That's a bad, bad person. And Peter says, should we launch a revolt? Maybe we should try to get everyone, all the Christians together and march on Rome. Obey. Keep your head down. Don't blow your cover. Submit yourself. Go along with it. It's like the Gestapo again. Get down. Keep your head down. And don't blow your cover. Keep the heat off because we've got work to do. It'd be foolish to do anything else. So too, he says, for such is the will of God, that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. One of the problems we're up against is just a simple misunderstanding of what Christians even are. We know in the early church, two of the main accusations against Christians was first that they practiced incest, and second that they were cannibals. They believed that. Why were they cannibals? It's because they heard them talking about the body and the blood of Jesus in the communion, and they thought, they're eating humans in there. Why are they practicing incest? Because they would see man and wife refer to each other as brother or sister in the Lord. Therefore, that's incest. They silence the ignorance of foolish men. Man. We've been slandered. I've been slandered. I remember I got into a talk on a blog where all these people were sounding off about how evil Zenos was. And one of them, I got on there and I started saying, refuting some things they were saying. And they were just like, coming at me. And this one guy was coming at me saying, Zenos rejected me. And that's all they ever do is reject people and so on and so forth. Nobody who read it knew. I knew exactly who it was. Of course, he never mentioned the fact that he had been in Zenos, a married man with children, that he had gotten onto crack, had become a crack addict, had abandoned his family, and lived in a junkyard in an abandoned car there, smoking crack day after day. A guy, which if anybody met this guy, you would just see immediately, he's got huge issues. No one would believe or put any credibility in anything this guy says. He's just like, completely zoned out, crazy. And yet on paper, on the screen, his words looked like anyone else's. And so you had slander. And very selective telling. Of course, I could have said, well, maybe you should tell him why you're a crack addict. And that might have had something to do with some of your friends in Zenos being down in your case. I didn't. Because basic country wisdom, never get into a pissing war with a skunk. Once you started that, he would just come back and anything goes. They'll lie. They're not going to necessarily tell the truth. The ignorance and foolishness which leads to slander. Well, he says in verse 16, act as free men and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bondslaves of God. Honor all men. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the king. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only those who are good and gentle, but also those who are unreasonable. Well, so this shows how far the full extreme to which he's ready to go, to keep your head down, to keep from drawing more hostility on us. Even servants, slaves, What should we do? Slavery's wrong. We know that Paul believed that slavery was wrong. He says, notice this. See how there's bond slaves of God and servants. Both are supposed to be submissive. We know Paul's thinking on this. He linked these together. In 1 Corinthians 7, he said, were you called while a slave? Don't worry about it. But if you're able to get free, rather do that. A lot of times slaves could buy their freedom in Roman culture. If they could come up with that money, or their friends could, they could sometimes buy freedom. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. But likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. So this is how in the theology of freedom, freedom isn't for us to use for self-indulgence. We're bond servants of Jesus. He called himself a slave of Christ. And so he saw this as kind of a balancing factor. Even if you had freedom from men, you would still be the slaves of Christ. And then he says, you were bought with price. Do not become the slaves of men. See, there's his anti-slavery right there. He did not think that people should be the slaves of other men, only of Christ. So he was anti-slavery. And yet he, like Peter, they both taught the same thing. Just do what your master says. And including if he's an idiot, do it anyway. Because we don't want to bring the heat down on us. You know, the Romans were already scared to death of a slave revolt. They had had a big slave revolt not too many years earlier. And they were afraid of another one. If the Christians already were pushing the line and were pushing it by allowing slaves to sit next to them, calling them brothers and sisters, treating them as equals, that scared Romans. They didn't like that at all. This is going to give slaves ideas. And then if any hint of a slave revolt had come, had been breathed, or maybe people shouldn't have slaves, what about that? That's all it would take to turn the ferocious, overwhelming might of Rome against this tiny little movement of a few thousand people. It just didn't make any sense. And besides, as he says, as slaves, you're the Lord's freedmen. We have to submit. So launching a slave revolt would have been really stupid. And Peter never did that. He says, for this finds favor, if for the sake of conscience toward God, a man bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. There, Peter is saying that slavery is unjust, unfair. But it's not because we're pleasing the person. It's because of conscience toward God. It's for God's sake that I will put up with this humiliation, with this oppression that I'm under. For he says, what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? None. But if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. Doers of good who are being persecuted anyway, what a picture. In one passage, Paul says, when people persecute you and curse you and you do good back to them, it's like pouring hot coals on your head. Overcoming evil with good. So when you do right and suffer for it. Yeah, that's what they were doing. It wasn't that they were in sin. The fact is that they were following God. They were doing the right thing. And for that, they were being persecuted. For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to, follow in his steps. Him who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. That's from Isaiah 53. That's about the suffering servant. Peter quoting about Jesus. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats. But he kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. For by his wounds you were healed. That's in Isaiah 53 also. Yeah, so Jesus, who really wasn't treated very fairly either, right? That was unjust, what happened to him. He had done nothing wrong. He's being beaten. He's being tortured. He's being crucified. And he lets it happen. He calls out, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Oh, and that's an example, he says, for us to follow. High order. It says, he's willing to be misunderstood, even at the end of his life, when he died. The verdict on Jesus was pretty negative. Even his followers basically looked on and just were like, "Can't believe that just happened. Let's go home. Might as well go back into fishing again. This is over. It's failed." They thought this whole thing had gone up in smoke. Not one person was waiting at the grave of Jesus saying, "Oh man, come on, when's he going to come out?" Not a single person. They all gave up. But he rose. This is an important statement here. Jesus himself bore our sins in his body on the cross so that we can die to sin and live to righteousness, for by his wounds you are healed. The cross. Jesus had all the sins of humanity sucked into him, and then he permitted himself to be crucified and canceling the debt for all of those sins. This is how we can be brought back. We can be healed. We can be brought back into fellowship with God. It's by the cross. And Jesus let this voluntary persecution happen to him out of love. But it's only there for you if you accept it. The gift. He's offering this to everybody. I can basically take all of your sins off your hands and count it on my death on the cross. You want that? You got to accept it. Got to tell God, "Okay, I'm up for it." We read in John 1 that as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become the children of God, even to those that believe in his name. You must receive the gift if you want it. You know, I can hold out a book to you here, but it's not yours until you reach out and take it. You got to do that with Christ. It's just done in the heart. You just let God know, "I'm ready. I'm ready to have my sins borne by Jesus on the cross. I want to be counted in on that so that I don't have to carry my own sins and pay my own price for them." And God's like, "Sold. Done. Free gift." So what we've seen here, first of all of these points I'm making are spiritual points. We're not really underground operatives, right? And some literal physical. We're not going to start a militia here. I'm speaking metaphorically. It's a spiritual battle. Don't forget that the people in our culture is not what we're opposing. They're the victims. They're the ones we're trying to help rescue with the love of God. And God's calling to us to represent him in this situation we find ourselves in, so that we can rescue those people from their slavery to this system. And that involves a lot of good works, as well as, we'll see later in the book, good words are also good, yeah. All right, let's draw the line here this week.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.